Building a portfolio with Fidelity Basket Portfolios is kind of like making a sandwich. It's as simple as picking your stocks and ETFs, sort of like your meats and other toppings, and managing it as one big, juicy investment. Mmm, now that's pretty good. Learn more at fidelity.com/baskets. Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE SIPC.
Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. 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 Get better at anything. 12 maxims for mastery. So I first met Scott Young almost 10 years ago when in a 12-month period, he basically finished all the requirements for a four-year MIT degree in computer science. So he's an expert at learning things quickly. He just wrote this book, Get Better at Anything, 12 Maxims for Mastery. And I had a chance to sit down and talk with him because I'm always interested in learning and learning about learning and how to get great at things. Scott Young is an expert at this. And on this episode, we talk all about it.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Scott, I think when were you first on the podcast? It was like many years ago.
Yeah, like a long time ago. You know what is so funny? Because when I was doing the proposal for Ultra Learning, and this is now probably 7 years ago or something like that. I'd never written a book, so I hadn't like been on a lot of podcasts. It wasn't like a big thing. So they're like podcast appearances. And I think it was like your show and maybe like Jordan Harbinger. So I'd been randomly invited to go on the show. And that, I think,
yeah,
probably 15 years ago, maybe.
Probably wasn't that long ago because I wasn't doing the podcast then, but maybe it was like
10, maybe.
Because here's the thing. Yeah. I sought you out because I saw that article there was an article about you, how you had essentially completed a four-year MIT degree in computer science in like what, a few weeks,
yeah,
few
like
months,
about
I forget what it was.
Months, but yeah, that was like my first big project. Yeah, I wrote an essay for Cal's website and it got some play and then, yeah, probably would have been around then. Yeah. Yeah, no, that would have been about 10 years ago. Yeah, that was 2012 maybe. Is that right? 2012, 2013?
Maybe a little after that, or something like that.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, you became like an expert on fast learning. And I've always been fascinated by this subject. Like, in fact, some of the experiments you refer to in your new book, I was participated in those experiments. Like, I've always been fascinated by, you know, and I've had on Anders Ericsson, I've had on others related to learning, I've written about learning. And, but tell a little bit about your story, like, first, and then we'll get into your book. And,
So, I mean, my background's kind of unusual. I started writing, it's like, I don't know, at least 15 years now that I've been writing online and often about learning, about studying. So these are like topics that are very close to my heart. We had a conversation when my first book came out, Ultra Learning, which was about some of my sort of self-directed learning projects and some other people's, like, you know, we mentioned the MIT Challenge, which was this learning MIT's computer science curriculum because they post tons of their classes online for free. And this was, you know, shortly after I graduated from business school, and it was like, has anyone ever tried to do this before? And I couldn't see anyone who had tried to do it before, so I tried to do it myself. And I also did a project learning languages. I went around the world learning learning Spanish, Portuguese, Mandarin Chinese, and Korean with a friend. And the kind of crux of that experiment was that we weren't going to speak English the whole time, so we were just like speaking the language of the place that we were learning it in. And, you know, I've done other things too. I know, I think the last time you had me on, we talked a lot about the portrait drawing one. I think you were interested in that one too, but like getting better at drawing people's faces and this kind of thing. And so those sort of like personal experiments, I think, really set up a love of like, what is the science of learning? How does this work? And like wanting to dive deeper into that and compiling a lot of that research, those ideas, those sort of like big fundamental concepts that I think shape how I think about it, was really putting together in this book, you know, over the last five years of research.
There's like learning something, but then there's meta-learning, which is learning the kind of structure of learning, like learning how to learn faster. And there's a great example of it, which I think is very interesting. And for a lot of people talk about this stuff. So like Anders Ericsson has the theory of if you spend 10,000 hours of deliberate practice, meaning do something, get feedback, repeat. If you spend 10,000 hours doing something like that, then you'll be among the best in the world. But then, but that's all and good, but A, people don't spend 10,000 hours in something. B, you don't have to be in the best of the world at speaking Portuguese in order to speak fluent Portuguese. Yeah. And C, it seems to only work for, Anders' theories mostly work for subjects that are repetitive tasks. So like memorizing a stream of numbers, for instance. And, but you have, in this book, Get Better at Anything, 12 Maxims for Mastery, you kind of dive into more specifics about what does it really take to learn? And I have questions all over the place, but, you know, I'm trying to figure out where to start here. But one thing that's always interesting to me is the importance of memory versus practice versus quantity. Like all these play a role, and pattern recognition. All these play a role. What's the most important? Is there any kind of, what's the role of talent in learning?
Oh, I mean, talent is obviously huge. I think the reason I don't really like talent as a concept is not because I don't think it exists. Like, I definitely think there's some people who are, you know, for whatever reason, they're just a little bit better at learning X, or they're better at reaching a higher level of X than other people are. But the reason I don't really like it is it's not really an explanation. It's not like pointing to like, oh, well, this is the thing that's different in their brain, which allows them to learn better. Like, at least intelligence, you know, is defined by psychologists as a little bit of a narrower concept, or like working memory capacity is an even narrower concept. So if someone said, oh, you have a greater working memory capacity and that's why you're good at physics, I kind of accept that as an explanation. But talent to me has always just been, well, we don't know why this person's better than this other person. And so we're just sort of like, well, you know, sometimes people are better than other people. Whereas I think the role of talent is definitely there, but I focus so much more on like the mechanisms, the things that underlie skill development, not to be dismissive of talent, but just to be like, I like an actual explanation for why this person is better than someone else. And so I'm really always interested in those mechanisms. And a lot of those have to do with practice. A lot of those have to do with, you know, how you're acquiring knowledge and how you're implementing it.
Let's talk about Annette Oberstadt. I don't know how to say her name. Annette Oberstadt.
Yeah, I think it's Annette Oberstadt,
At the age of 19, or right before she became 19, she was the youngest ever winner of a World Series of Poker tournament. And she's won like, you know, $3.9 million from poker. What did she do?
Yeah.
Poker is such a fascinating topic, and it's a really great domain because it's a closed system in that there's a set of rules, as opposed to like writing where there's really no rules.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a set of rules, and there's also imperfect information. Like, you know what cards you have in your hand, but you don't know what cards are in the other people's hands. So it's a type of game called an imperfect information game. So particularly difficult to learn. There's this psychological aspect, there's statistics, there's the role of, there's obviously psychology involved. So how did she learn to be one of the greatest poker players by the age of 19?
Yeah. So, I mean, Annette is just such a fun example of a breed of player. So I don't even use her as like saying, okay, well, Annette is the best poker player who's ever lived, but just as an example of a generation of poker players that grew up playing online. Because prior to this, so there's this guy, Chris Moneymaker, who was like an accountant, and he did like a $39 buy-in at some like online poker site. And that led to him winning the American World Series of Poker tournament. And it was, I don't know, some millions of dollars from that. And him just being like, oh, some random guy who's just playing online won millions of dollars, just created this explosion in online poker. And I think if you just look at the before and after of this trend, before it was like, well, you had to be one of these kind of chain-smoking casino guys to learn the game. You were at the high-stakes table. You're playing hand after hand and after hand. And yeah, you're writing things down. You're keeping track of stuff. But I mean, your memory's limited. You're only able to play so many hands. You can only sit at one table at a time. Whereas, poker players like Annette, they're playing online. They're playing in their basement. They can, you know, sometimes have like several games open at once. They have the entire history of every play that anyone ever made. So they can download like their hand history and be like, oh, you make suboptimal moves in this particular situation. And so you can get that kind of feedback and improve on it. So I think it's an example of, you know, someone who clearly has talent, someone who clearly has motivation to learn, but at the same time is in an environment where she can just get this rapid feedback, get really accurate, you know, calibration of what she's doing right, what she's doing wrong. And so she's just able to learn so much faster than maybe a previous generation could have for learning poker.
Right. So I think somebody Dan Negreanu says in that same chapter that Doyle Brunson, who was 80 years old at the time, now he's passed away. But Doyle Brunson's been playing for 70 years of his life and he still hasn't played as many hands as some of these like 15-year-olds who are playing online because they could play 20 hands at any given moment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know whether like Negreanu's statement is entirely accurate, but I just thought it was really good example of a quote of like a professional poker player who's just commenting on these kids who are coming up through this system are just getting so much feedback. And I think also the online play shifted the nature of the game too, because I think when you are playing online, there's a certain, you know, they're like, you don't have to have the poker face problem. There's less of like the chit chat and reading tales. And so the game became more mathematical. It became more about like analyzing what's the correct move in the right position. And I even allude to like, you know, MIT offered a poker theory course at their like Sloan School of Management. And it's all like extremely esoteric math for like what's the right move in the right situations and stuff, which is so removed from Doyle Brunson, you know, his cowboy hat wearing kind of like, well, you know, I got to trust my gut on this thing. This person's sort of like this. And I got kind of a feeling about this that you should do this. And, you know, Doyle Brunson was a good poker player, but he relied, I think, more on psychology than a lot of this like game theory analysis, which is how the game has changed it as it moved online.
So you're saying with Annette, she had a couple of benefits that have sped along her learning.
Yeah.
One is she was able to play a massive amount of hands.
Yeah.
And what's the benefit? We'll talk more about quantity, but what's the benefit of playing a massive amount of hands? I mean, if she has bad habits, maybe that just underlines her bad habits.
Yeah, I mean, definitely quantity just alone does not guarantee proficiency. And, you know, I even talk about the alternate example where, you know, you have psychologists or psychiatrists who have to make predictions and they have tons of experience and they tend to make bad predictions. So I don't think it's necessarily the case that just doing lots and lots of practice makes you better. But for a game like poker, which is played under uncertainty, so you could like make a decision and maybe the decision is the right decision, but you'll only find out whether you won like 55% of the time. So just to train your intuition on that, you have to play that exact situation you know, multiple times, maybe even dozens of times before you have like a real good feeling for what's the right move in that situation. And so having a lot of experience, having a lot of exposure tends to average out a lot of these sort of idiosyncrasies. Whereas, you know, if you weren't too sophisticated in playing and you just play one hand, you did this one time and it worked, or you did it three times and it worked, you know, that may not be enough to really like statistically have that good intuition about it. So I think the quantity helps with averaging out outcomes. I think that's certainly true of lots of skills. But then also the fact that you're playing online, you're getting this huge hand practice. You can do this analysis, you can do this calibration so that, you know, you have some mental model of like, what is the correct move in certain situations. And so you can very clearly see whether you're making those 55% bets in your favor or you're making 45% bets in your favor and losing a lot in the long run.
Did she have a coach?
I don't think so. You know, and that's like a really funny case because she just seemed like just someone who just, you know, had a knack for poker, played it a ton. You know, I talk about Tetris people at the beginning of the book, but like some kids, you know, they just get obsessed with something. They do it a lot. And because it's a narrow skill, they get really good at it. And yeah, she was like, started off with the free money games because of course she legally isn't allowed to gamble, won some money through that, and then just like bankrolled this like huge, huge fortune from there. So, I mean, I don't know. I think maybe she, when she was getting a little bit more advanced, she was definitely in the poker community. She knows some of these people. There's even a video online of her playing Doyle Brunson that I remember watching. So like she would have been, had access to those peers and networks and knowledge. So I don't want to say she's just like out of the blue, but definitely like her early success. I mean, she's like a high school kid. She's not, you know, she's not even legally allowed to gamble. Yeah.
Because the benefit of a coach or some, she needs some way to understand, to get feedback.
Yeah.
So like she makes a bet in a hand, she tries something and it doesn't work. She still needs to know, was that the right decision or not? So like, let's say she, you know, just to use some poker terms, she semi-bluffed on the flop and it didn't work out. Mm-hmm. But her decision to bluff was correct.
Yeah.
And so she has to know how to categorize the different situations that arise. Like why is it a semi-bluff versus a bluff, for instance? What is the situation? Does she have a pair of sevens? So she might have the highest hand, but she probably doesn't. Yeah. But then everybody folds. And so it was a good decision. What she has to know how to categorize or label the situations so that when she says, oh, I'm in the same situation I was in before, and I knew that was 55% chance of being good, I should do it again.
Yeah. I mean, well, poker just has this strong advantage in that it's a game that's really, like, it is somewhat at least mathematically tractable. So there is, in some sense, a correct answer for certain moves of like, you know, should I have done this given what I knew? I mean, the thing that makes it more complicated is there's this sort of recursive game of like, well, I know that they know that I know that, it, you know, like this kind of back and forth. But I mean, these are mathematical things that you can work out. So this is something like you feed your hand history into like poker software and you can get information about like how you're playing. And so if you think, oh, well, you know, I'm playing this way, but then you're finding out, okay, you're actually playing a little too loose here. You're playing these hands maybe more than you should be playing them compared to like where you're playing other hands. And that's kind of creating a pattern in your play and this kind of thing. So I do think like the thing that a coach does is they stand outside yourself and they give you information that maybe you don't have access to. And so in games that are, you know, mathematical, like chess is another really good example where, you know, you can run your moves into like a chess engine and it can tell you whether or not it thinks they're good moves. Like that's in some ways better than the chess coaches of the, like, you know, Bobby Fischer days, because the chess engine's much better at chess than any human being is. So I think having access to models, having access to things is very important, particularly for a game like poker, at least as a first pass. I mean, it doesn't deal with the human element, but it gives you that kind of, am I in the right ballpark? And I think Annette, you know, she even talks about playing games where she played it blindfolded. She seemed to be someone who played a lot from position. And so her sort of whole strategy, her whole thinking was kind of like, you know, knowing that, okay, I'm in this position in the play, so I need to play this way, not even based on what my own cards are, but just based on where I am in the sequence of bets.
Yeah, so she's able to somehow understand the situation she's in. Like, she's in early position.
Yeah.
She's got a low pair, a mid pair, a high pair. She knows how to play in different situations. And I think, so there's quantity, but also kind of labeling what each situation is. And then based on the label and the decision you make in that situation, getting some feedback and then repeat, but then having an enormous number of repetitions.
Yeah, and the feedback, I think the feedback is important in a poker game because it's like assuming you're not cheating or assuming you're not using like software while you're doing it, you are making these fairly fast decisions. And even if you're basing some math, you're doing some calculation of pot odds and this kind of thing, you know, you're using your fallible human computer to make these assessments. And so I think that where the feedback really helps is in calibrating like, do the gut decisions that I'm making in these moments actually match up with what I think the correct strategy should be or what I think I should be playing? And so the additional discrepancy is like the with what I think I should be playing versus like what is a successful play. And so I think for that latter one, that's where poker theory, that's where knowing other players, that's where you're getting this information about like, you know, whether or not in general you're playing too loose or too tight or too, you know, whatever.
Take a quick break. If you like this episode, I'd really, really appreciate it. It would mean so much to me. Please share it with your friends and subscribe to the podcast. Email me at altitra@gmail.com and tell me why you subscribed. Thanks. I have to say, Airbnb has changed my life. I just love staying in Airbnbs. Like in about a month, I'm going to Cocoa Beach, which is right next to Cape Canaveral. I'm going to watch some rocket launches. I'm going to, of course, be staying in a very nice Airbnb on the beach. And it's just such a great experience. Like the whole world is available to us now because of Airbnb. But whenever I'm at an Airbnb, I always realize, you know, the home that I left to come to this Airbnb, I could be making money on that right now by hosting and being an Airbnb myself. So, and I've known people, I had a friend who basically, you know, made a living from turning his home into an Airbnb. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you do have an Airbnb there. And it can easily fit into your lifestyle, and it's a great way to earn some money. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. The famous Abraham Lincoln quote says, "Good things come to those who wait." I wonder, did he really say that? Jay, did he really say that? Can you look that up? Regardless of who said it, that's only part of the quote. The full quote is, "Good things come to those who wait, but only the things left by those who hustle." Well, if you're a business owner and want the best people on your team, the same applies. And listen, I've interviewed 1,500 people now and a lot of entrepreneurs. I can safely say the one thing consistent among all entrepreneurs and CEOs, the successful ones, is that it's all about the people you surround yourself. If you hire well, you're going to have a great business. And, you know, thankfully, ZipRecruiter puts the hustle in your hiring so you find qualified candidates fast. This is so important, and I want you to try it. You could try it as a potential employer or employee. You could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter's smart technology finds top talent for your roles right away. Immediately after you post your job, if you're hiring, ZipRecruiter's matching technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I will tell you that I signed up on ZipRecruiter as a potential employee. You know, I just wanted to see how it works. And right away, it started matching me with really amazing potential employers. So give it a try at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Let ZipRecruiter give you the hiring hustle you need. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/James to try it for free. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. I mean, there's so many things you talk about here. I really think very important is quantity. Mm-hmm. And like Picasso's created over 100,000 works of art. Yeah. Edison's had thousands of inventions. Yeah. I remember when the Andy Warhol Museum opened up. I was living in Pittsburgh when I was going to grad school there. The Andy Warhol Museum opened up and there were 9 floors. And the first day I remember walking through all 9 floors thinking, oh my gosh, like how could he fill 9 floors of a museum? But quantity is a real good way to get good.
Yeah. And I mean, it's interesting. Like this chapter that I wrote was one of those ones where like the research I thought was so interesting and surprising. It was like, well, I feel like I need to share this. So this is based on Dean Simonton. He's a psychologist whose primary method is historical. So he looks at like tons and tons of case studies and takes like quantitative data about it. So he's done a lot of stuff on like what's the career trajectory of people in different fields, artists, scientists, eminent individuals, you know, what is their shape of their career trajectory? When do they have their successes, their breakouts, this kind of thing. So he's answered lots of questions using this kind of historical data. And one of the things that I found very provocative about his research is that he has this idea he calls the equal odds baseline, which is basically that once you sort of reach a threshold of producing kind of eminent work, so I mean his samples, because they tend to focus on people who are like already kind of at the top of the field, we're sort of omitting maybe the people who, you know, they haven't yet reached a point where they're publishing a recognized play or producing papers for a journal or something. But once they're in this zone, there tends to be a fairly flat, you know, ratio in terms of the work that they're doing and how likely it is to be successful or the quality of it, which to me is kind of surprising because it kind of contradicts a few different models you might have. You might have the model that like, you know, the Anders Ericsson, like people just continually getting better. And I mean, that's not saying that's impossible, but it just seems to deny that that's actually what's happening. Or the idea that you have like youthful genius so that people, their quality drops off as they get older. You know, they have that spark when they're 20, but when they're 75, they lose it. And, you know, he notices that people's productivity goes up and goes down, but their hit rate is relatively stable over time. And just that the idea that quality and quantity don't seem to be in trade-off and that in fact they're like highly correlated in these historical samples seems to suggest that, you know, once you get to some sort of threshold, there's a great deal of randomness. So it's a little bit like the poker players, like you have to make quite a few bets in order for it to like average out and for you to have some big wins. And so I think that's a bit of a different way of thinking about creative success than we're often taught, which is, you know, where quantity and quality are like sharply opposed, and you know, you can either make something good or you can make a lot of something, and you have to really choose what kind of creative you're going to be.
But like, let's say I'm playing golf. Mm-hmm. Okay, in order to get better, and I'm not a golf player at all. I've played like maybe twice in my life, but it seems like in order to get better at golf, and you have a great quote. I think this is about this guy who created a training program for flying airplanes. Mm-hmm. And he basically says, in order to get better at flying an airplane, you have to fly an airplane. You can't just watch, like, I can't just watch videos about people playing golf.
Yeah.
Oh, here's how Tiger Woods swings. Like, maybe I learn a little bit from that, but ultimately I have to swing a golf club a lot and get feedback. And this is more to the Anders Ericsson's point. Yeah. It's quantity plus feedback. And that's where the 10,000 hours comes in. It's not good enough just to be taught in a classroom. You have to actually do something.
Well, I mean, a lot of skills, especially as you sort of progress with them, they become more specific. They become more tuned to the environment that you practice in. And so I think like a very common pattern amongst many skills and lots of different things. So like I talk about pilot training is one example of this, but you can think like of many, many different subjects where this would apply, is that in the very early phases, there's a benefit to classroom instruction because classroom instruction tends to make like the explicit understanding of the skill a little easier. Like someone that tells you, okay, you know, swing the club this way, and then like they'll show you, and you watch them, and that's beneficial. If you've never seen anyone golf before and you try to do it yourself, you're not going to like automatically recreate a really good golf swing. But once you get past that sort of cognitive phase where you understand it intellectually, I mean, you're developing procedural skill. You're developing this sort of, I don't like the word muscle memory, but that's basically what it is. It's a skill that you're applying unconsciously, and sitting more time in the classroom is probably not going to help with that.
Right. Like I took 5 years of French, for instance, but I can't speak a word of French. And I couldn't speak a word of French the day after my fifth year of French studying, took place. And even computer science, where I was undergrad computer science. I went to grad school for computer science. Mm-hmm. I was a programmer. But when I was in a real world job setting, I really couldn't program. And so doing is incredibly important as opposed to the classroom, which makes me question a lot of today's educational methods.
Yeah.
But one important thing is pattern recognition. Mm-hmm. And so I play chess, and you talk, you discuss this in the book, that basically chess players, when they are trying to recreate a position that they've seen for, let's say, 60 seconds, they recreate it by looking, they don't remember where every single piece is on the 64 squares. They recognize, oh, you know, I castled my king over here. I my bishops are in these formations. Whereas someone who's never played is trying to remember what piece was on every 64 squares and fails remarkably.
Yeah.
And even like a world level chess player, if he's shown a random position, is no better than the amateur. So if you see a if they see a position from a game, it's really not 64 squares. It's like four or five configurations of pieces.
Yeah.
And that's easy to remember as opposed to 64 things you have to remember.
Yeah. So this idea that we're talking about here is called the chunking, and it was. So chess is kind of has like a long history in the cognitive science of skill development and studying a lot of these differences. And so a lot of the classic examples are with chess. But the idea is like, how does the grandmaster think? Like, how are they able to manipulate more? And one of the major kind of limitations on performing complicated skills is that we have this thing called working memory. It's what we're keeping in mind at any particular time. And it's famously very limited. You can't actually keep that many things in your head at once. And so one of the ways that people who are quite good at a skill get around this is that you assemble through experience, through long-term memory, patterns that kind of are assemblages of material that you have in the environment, so you don't have to keep as many things in mind at once. So I think the really easy example to like show this at work is if I just like sputtered off like a random 9 sequence of letters, it'd be very difficult for you to just remember them, like just recall all of them. But if I said those same 9 letters, but they were reorganized into acronyms, you know, like FBI, MBA, you know, NBA, that kind of thing, you would remember them easily because now you only have to remember 3 things instead of 9 things. And that's much more within the capacity of human working memory. And so the idea here is that the grandmaster is doing something similar. They don't see the board and see, you know, okay, well, the king is here, the pawn is here, the pawn is here. You know, they are recognizing the position, but they recognize the meaning of those patterns that like, oh yeah, well, this was the, you know, Berlin defense, but they made this option instead, or, you know, they got into this situation, this is castle on this side. And so because they have these sort of like the equivalent of acronyms of the information in their head, they can recall a lot more. And so the classic experiment is that you set up the board and you wipe it and you ask them to recreate it, and grandmasters can assemble much more of the board. But if you just scramble the pieces and you put them in a place that like no game would ever result in that, they don't have acronyms for those positions. And so they don't do much better than novices.
Right. It's as if if you give someone a string of letters and they actually can't reform them into acronyms.
Yeah.
Maybe there are no acronyms with those letters. And so now they're just like anybody else who has to remember a string of 20 letters as opposed to 4 acronyms.
Yeah. And I mean, I think one of the things that is like important to keep in mind is that this working memory is central to what we often think about as intelligence, that, you know, it's pretty tightly linked to how smart do we think someone is probably pretty closely related to like, what is their raw working memory capacity. But in a particular skill domain, because of this chunking effect, you effectively have more working memory capacity when you have more experience. So that means like, if you are totally new to a domain, it's kind of like being a lot less smart because you aren't able to deal with as much information. And so this has a very strong impact on like, what's the right way to learn skills? Because early on, you know, the situation is just too complicated. You can't keep it in your head. And so you like, you know, make mistakes that for someone who's very seasoned, they can easily keep it in their head. They're going to face totally different problems with learning and improvement.
So it seems like quantity, in order to get exposure to lots of acronyms, like in the string of letters example, like studying all the acronyms ever and then having the ability to reform a string of random letters into acronyms would be a skill for memorizing long strings of letters. So you need to be exposed to a lot of situations, like in the poker example, Annette needs to be exposed to lots of poker hands and then to categorize them into if then. So if I'm in this situation, then do this.
Yeah.
And that somehow involves either like a computer to tell her she's right or wrong, or a coach or whatever. So quantity plus some sort of somebody who's going to tell you this is a chunk, and then being able to have the memory to remember all these chunks.
Yeah. I mean, I think that often, like when we're talking about poker, for instance, there's probably some idealized strategy. So you have some strategy that would be, okay, well, I'm going to play these hands this way from this position. And so, you know, you can imagine it like, yeah, if it's poker, it's probably going to be some kind of table. And maybe you're adjusting it based on the players you're playing against and this kind of thing. And the difficulty is that when you're starting out, keeping that table in your head and keeping that strategy like fixed in an actual game is basically impossible. So that's what the learning is coming in, is that you are doing things and comparing it to what you should have been doing and then like trying to, you know, build that experience for next time. So definitely repetition and exposure to lots of information is going to be helpful. It's going to be necessary for a lot of skills that have a lot of individual building blocks. But again, if you don't have that strategy, if you don't have the like the right thing you're comparing it to, you can get lots and lots of experience and just, you know, not learn anything or not make that much progress.
Another interesting thing is the difference between variability and consistency. So like when we learn math in school, let's say in high school, you start off with, okay, well, now we're going to learn this type of equation. And then our test at the end is only about that type of equation. Then we learn how to solve another type of equation. Then the test at the end is only about that. And then we have the final, and it might even, the final might even be organized chronologically. Like, okay, it starts off with the early equations. Then the next part is the second equation. And the argument you make, backed up by research, is that it's important to not test in order, but to almost randomize the like you've learned a bunch of things. Now let's randomize the questions when you're tested so that your brain has to get used to also identifying what type of situation am I in, as opposed to being making it easy to figure out what type of situation I'm in.
Yeah, so this is an idea called contextual interference. And the basic way you can summarize it is there's like knowing how to do something. So like knowing how to solve an algebra problem. And then there's knowing when you need to access and use that knowledge. And so the thing is that obviously it's easier to learn how to do something if you do it under very regular constrained conditions where like I tell you exactly what you need to do. But that is the easiest possible situation for when do I use this knowledge? When do I use it? And so, you know, in schools, because often the applications are a little bit more distant, there is tend to be a prioritization of like actually learning the procedure, but there can often be a deficit in applying the procedure. So, you know, we were talking about this, like you do unit one and you do unit one questions. Well, already your brain is like, well, it's got to be something from unit one. So if I, you know, I learn five things, it's got to be one of those five things. That, and then that's how I, you know, I pattern match to what's variables are there and then I apply it. Whereas, you know, if you think of yourself in the overall context of the classroom, well, there maybe is 10 units. So maybe there's 50 things that you were supposed to know how to do. But if you really think about it, you know, once you're outside of the classroom and then you're in real life and someone throws you a quantitative problem that like maybe that knowledge that you used in the class could apply, what's the chances that you retrieve it? Well, probably pretty low, because you're not just thinking about that particular class. You're thinking about all the math that you maybe learned and then also the possibility that the right answer is not something you've learned before. And so this variable practice, this you know, mixing things up is about making that process of retrieving the right knowledge at the right time easier. And that's really important for flexible skills, for being able to apply skills broadly, to invent things, to improvise.
Yeah, I'll give you an example in chess. Mm-hmm. So there's a category of problems to get better at chess. Often people have to solve problems because you can't always be playing games. Mm-hmm. So there might be a problem that says white to move and win in two moves.
Yeah.
And so you know you're in a situation where white can win in two moves. Mm-hmm. So you're basically just looking for like the most crazy extreme moves to solve this problem, and you know it's going to win. Whereas if you're in a real game, you don't know if white's winning or black's winning. Yeah. Maybe it's black to win in two moves and you're trying to win in two moves for white. You just don't know. So there's lots of different types of problems like that. And so I think it's a new thing in chess, people realizing that variability is important. So, oh, maybe it's white to move and win. Here and maybe in this next problem, you have to figure out who's winning and then what, maybe you have to defend. Maybe it's white to move and defend against black moving. But that variability is sort of a fairly new thing in chess learning. I'm trying to think like for language learning, it might be a similar thing. Like, oh, instead of maybe 1 week in class, this is phrases you use in a restaurant. And here is another one, phrases you use, you know, in a job interview. But in a test, you should mix it up. Like if someone says this, say this, and it's, you should mix it up whether depending on the, and you have to figure out the situation also.
Yeah. I mean, I think you definitely want to expand the range of situations you apply it to match where you think you're actually going to use the skill. Because I think one of the main difficulties we have with learning things is that you can put knowledge in your head, but in order for it to be useful, you have to get it out at the right time. And so we have, you know, we have huge amounts of knowledge that we learned in school, that we've learned from books, learning these kind of things, that if I give you a very specific prompt, like something that really focuses in on that piece of knowledge, you might even remember it. You might be like, oh yeah, I sort of remember that book, or I sort of remember that idea that I learned from school. But if I don't give you that highly specific cue, it's just not going to occur to you in a situation. And so the real difficulty is that a lot of the problem situations that we face, you know, they don't have little strings attached with a tag saying like, this is the knowledge you need to solve this problem. They don't say like, oh, unit one, dat point one, use the formula that you learned in class. And so when you don't have that tag attached to it, the retrieval problem becomes really important. And so I think this is sort of something that's often missing from a lot of school services. You talked about struggling learning French. And I mean, some of that is just that like you're in the French context where you know, you're learning some grammar pattern and it's saying, okay, like practice the subjunctive. But I mean, a big part of it is like, when do I use the subjunctive? Like, when is the situation when I'm having this conversation that I have to use the subjunctive? And if you don't know that, then it doesn't matter that you've memorized that, well, this is the correct way to conjugate it. You know what I mean? That's sort of a secondary thing. So especially with school-based knowledge, I think this kind of variable practice, retrieval practice, applying in diverse contexts is often lacking.
Hey, Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. Member NYSE, SIPC.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
So there's two skills in this context, in this yeah. sense. One is the skill of, you know, learning a lot of, in this situation, do this, which is the problem with not having variable. Then there's the skill of identifying, well, what situation am I in? Yeah. So then I can apply that rule.
Yeah.
So, and that's difficult. Like that's not typically taught in school. So the question, so really let's take it all the way back. Yeah. Let's say you wanted to learn golf or how yeah. to play the piano. What would you personally start doing?
Yeah, so I think for piano, I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time doing the detailed research on piano, so I think I probably would have more sophisticated opinions if I narrowed in on that particular topic. But if I were just like, okay, I want to learn the piano now, I think one of the first things I would do is focus on, well, what is the sort of like basic methods? So like, how should I have my hands over the keys? Where should I be pressing with which fingers? I would look at like what are common like beginner crutches that you want to avoid, because I know from talking to piano teachers.
Yeah. So like, what would you actually do? Like from a meta sense, like yeah. how would you start organizing the learning?
Yeah.
Like, what would you need? What in your arsenal, what do you need in your toolbox to say, I'm going to start learning piano a month from now. But so here's the things I have to gather and put into place so I can start learning.
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I do whenever I'm tackling any new skill is I would look at like, okay, skim through some curricula that people have for teaching piano. So like get like the top 5 books on learning piano, skim through them. What do they actually get you to practice? What do they get you to do? Why do they get you to focus on doing X first before Y? I'd find a few piano tutors. I would talk to them about like, what are the mistakes that beginners make that they get stuck with? Because piano is a motor skill. It's like highly overlearned. And so if there's like a, well, you're going to want to do this because it's more comfortable, but it's going to screw you up later, that's good to know. Because, you know, it's a little bit like if you're learning to touch type, it's a lot easier to hunt and peck with two fingers in the beginning, but that's a really bad habit to get into. It's going to really impede your ability to type at like higher words per minute. And so similarly with piano, if it would be like, okay, this is the sort of home row for the keys. This is where you want to, you hit this with this finger, hit this with that finger, you know, practice doing it this way. I would get those steps. And then I would just build up a curriculum of like starting with simpler either songs or like drills, and then just sort of building up until I can get more and more fluency. And I think as you get better as well, you can start to like branch out and be like, well, I want to be a jazz pianist, or I want to play classical music, or I want to play like, you know, little pop ditties that I've, you know, downloaded the sheet music for. And so I think that kind of a way of like figuring out what the curriculum is, how do people structure the skill? How do people who've taught it for many years, like what are the bad habits to avoid? That would be the grounding. And then you would be, you know, creating a practice sequence for yourself and hopefully having some coaching to like tell you, you know, what you're doing wrong.
And then let's go take it a step further. What if you also wanted to be creative? So creativity seems to be like a
like
positive
with the piano?
Symptom of, yeah, piano, music, whatever. Creativity is a symptom of knowing a lot.
Yeah.
So if you know a lot about, it's hard to be creative. It's hard to be a creative writer. Kurt Vonnegut even said, like, don't experiment with grammar until you know the rules of grammar. So, and what he's really saying is don't be a creative genius with writing your first novel. Like, write first and get good. And then you can start experimenting. And you refer to this, like, you want to, creativity is a way of expanding the problem space, but first you have to know the problem space.
Yeah. So I do think that like for a skill like piano, there's a bit of tension because there's this sort of largely procedural, you know, you could say almost like even like a muscular skill, a motor skill of hitting the keys. And I think that's probably different from the creative skill of original composition. So like you could be someone who's just literally writing notes on the page. They can't play the piano at all. And that would be a different kind of intellectual skill than playing the piano. So I have a feeling that the creative skill probably depends on knowing a lot of music. So you would know tons and tons of different music. You'd know, okay, well, this is like you'd have 18 different versions of the sheet music for like a sad song or a happy song in your head. You'd have, oh, this is a, you know, a technique for doing this, a technique for doing that. You'd have this huge library so that when you put things, you're not like, you're not plagiarizing, but you are kind of like building off of these abstract patterns of like, these are the things that are possible with the music. And, you know, you could have that skill, I think, in theory without being able to play an instrument at all. I think it's often intertwined with playing an instrument, because when you can play the instrument, you can hear it, you can get like, you get that self feedback. But I think, you know, nowadays where you have so much like digital recording where you can actually just like take that sheet music, put it into a computer and like get the computer to play it. It's not obvious to me that the motor skill of playing the instrument is necessary for creativity. Although I'm sure I'll hear from some musicians that can maybe point to me for a reason why that's not true. But
no, I mean, there are composers who are creative without knowing the instruments they were composing for. So like, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I'm just going to use it as an example. Beethoven probably couldn't play every single instrument in a symphony, but he could write symphonies because he knew music theory.
Yeah.
So like there's the motor skills, but then there's the theory of why two notes sound good together. Why C, E, G is a major C chord. And when you go, I don't know, E flat, now it's a minor chord. Yeah. And so it feels a little sadder. It's like, so someone would have to teach you music theory. Like you have an example in here of a jazz musician. Jazz is known for improvising the notes. And a guy who had just learned the motor skills, basically, he couldn't really do it as well until he learned kind of music theory as well.
Yeah, I mean, jazz is kind of an interesting one because like the history of jazz is it sort of learned more informally, like, you know, it kind of comes out of this culture of like black music in the United States. And so it's learned a lot more informally at like jam sessions and this kind of stuff. And so the lore of the music is much more based in like these individual communities is playing with individual people, as opposed to like a lot of classical music, which has been, you know, written about and analyzed and, you know, dissected in books quite a bit. And so I thought that was very interesting about this example, that like people who spend a lot of time in the community and you've been playing and you've been rehearsing, you've been working with people, you develop that kind of library. So, you know, one of the examples, I think it was maybe Carmen Lundy, I quote in the book, she talks about how, like, you know, in the beginning she could recognize jazz licks, and then she was like, oh, this is bebop licks. And then it's like, oh, this is a Sonny Rollins lick, or this is a Charlie Parker lick. Like, you've gotten to this specific thing where, you know, this little phrasing is associated with a particular performer, which, I mean, you know, for me, who's not like very much outside the jazz world, I'm listening to it and I'm like, yeah, that's jazz. You know, I don't have that level of nuance and sophistication. And so there's something almost literary about it, like the way that, you know, if you're a really great writer, you know so much writing that you can't help but have illusions in your work, just because that knowledge is going to be with you when you're writing.
But, you know, writing is an interesting domain too, because you could read, let's say you read 1,000 books, 1,000 novels. Let's say, let's talk about fiction in general. So 1,000 novels, and let's say you write a bunch of novels. So you can tell a pretty good, you know what a pretty good story looks like, and you could tell a pretty good story. But then it also is useful to, like, meta learn what a story is. So reading Joseph Campbell's The Hero's Journey. Oh, here's this very popular theory that seems to work about what the structure of a story is. Like, you know, the hero has a call to action. He rejects it. He has problems. He has allies. He reaches a point where it seems like all hope is lost. And then, boom, he solves it and returns to tell the tale. So it seems like there are these rules, too, on top of the domain, which are very helpful. So, like, for instance, with piano or jazz, you could learn the instrument and the motor skills and be very good and can repeat songs that you hear in your head, and you could have perfect pitch. But then knowing how to turn a major chord into a minor chord, like knowing these basics of music theory, could then help you improvise and be creative. But you have to know this theory on top of the skills.
Yeah, I mean, I think of the theory, like, in the way you're talking about it, as being part of the skills, that, like, it's, you know, it's not generally the case that just looking at finished products of work. So, like, looking at a finished painting, you just do that endlessly. It's not going to make you a good painter, because being a good painter requires the sort of problem-solving steps that go into producing that. So, like, what was the problem they were struggling with? How did they solve that problem? And sometimes it's, you know, very superficial or basic, like, oh, if you want to draw a leaf, do it like this. And that's, you know, there's not that much theory behind it. But I mean, in most work, most cognitive or intellectual domains, the way you solve the problem is through some kind of abstraction. So if you're dealing with, you know, okay, how do I make a good painting composition? Well, you have some ideas of color theory. You have some ideas about, like, well, I'm putting this here, so I have to have something smaller here. I'm doing this here, so it has to be over here. Otherwise, it's going to look unbalanced. And these are kind of more abstract ideas you develop. So I think music theory, especially because it has such mathematical roots, there's a lot of development in terms of, you know, ideas for, like, well, why does this thing sound good and this thing doesn't sound good? Or why does this thing sound like, you know, gives you a certain feeling and this thing doesn't? And so people have done a lot of work to try to figure out what are the moves you can make in this abstract space that ultimately boils down to a certain set of notes or a certain set of, you know, movements that you're making with an instrument.
So, like, with chess, and in these experiments that they've done about chunking,
they basically say
a grandmaster who's like a top chess player has about 100,000 chunks in their memory. Like, they recognize separately 100,000 different types of chess positions. And a master level player has about 10,000 chunks. And of course, an amateur or beginner has zero or close to zero. And my problem is, particularly as I'm older, so I'm 56, and my problem is I'll forget. I'll see a chunk over and over, and the coach will say, in this situation, you do this. Mm-hmm. In this situation, you do this. And we'll go over this same type of chunk over and over again, but then I'll forget.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if there's something higher level. So this causes players, in maybe in any domain, to have a plateau. Like, I can't seem to learn more because my memory is, like, full. Or at least I only remember the things I learned when I was younger and not the things I've learned recently. So I'm wondering if there's something even higher, like just a rules-based approach where if, and I just like spell it out, if this kind of configuration exists, do this in general.
Yeah.
So then I don't have to remember all the chunks. I just have to remember these rules. I wonder, like, what domains would you say are rule-based?
Yeah. So, well, I think there's a lot of stuff to potentially like pull on there in what you brought up. But one of the things I would say is that, you know, a distinction that I didn't end up writing about it in the book, but is a very important distinction from cognitive science, is they separate declarative memory from procedural memory. Declarative memory is all the things that you think about when you actually think about memory, which is the stuff you can explicitly remember. So, you know, names, faces, memories from your childhood, those are all declarative memory. And then procedural memory is skill memory. It is kind of what you're talking about, this sort of if-then rule-based system. So there is some evidence that these are like two different memory systems and they sort of work according to different rules. And procedural memory tends to be something that when you acquire it, it's often more durable. So, you know, that's why they say it's like learning to ride a bicycle and not like learning trigonometry, because trigonometry is for most of us a largely declarative skill. We've, you know, you remember the, you know, SOHCAHTOA or whatever you remember from high school, but maybe you like, unless you've done it so many times in your work, it's not just something you do through kind of like almost muscle memory. But the idea here is that often when you're learning skills, they start out declarative. You start out with some kind of explicit representation of it, some kind of deliberate memory that you're retrieving, and then it switches into a more procedural skill. So you develop procedures for doing it automatically in particular situations. And so a lot of our intuition may be this like procedural memory taking over.
Procedural memory, is that like pattern recognition?
Well, I think pattern recognition is in declarative memory too, because like the chunks would probably be, in most theories, they're declarative memory. So it's something that like you see NHL and that's just a meaningful pattern to you. You see NHL, so it's in that explicit memory. Whereas the procedural memory is a little bit more like when I see NHL, I'm like, I don't know, better with chess. It's like when I see that the king is in this position, I do this, right? So it's more like a if-then kind of pattern, like this, conditional, actional kind of pattern for things. And so that's probably important for things like, you know, if you're solving a math problem, it's like, well, when this is the math problem, this is the form, you do this. And then that's stored in that kind of memory. Whereas like the ability to explain why you do the problem that way is in declarative memory. So they kind of form different rules. I think they work in slightly different ways.
See, like, I think my problem is like, so a grandmaster will look at a chess position and say, oh, I see these chunks. Whereas I'm worried I can no longer remember, do the pattern recognition as well as when I was younger.
Yeah.
So I have to explicitly say to myself, oh, if I have two bishops and they don't, I have to blow open the position somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas a grandmaster will sort of recognize, okay, I'm in this type of position with two bishops. He might not even like verbalize it and just will know what to do. Whereas I'm starting to think I can't do the pattern recognition anymore, and I have to kind of explicitly almost write down what the patterns are, what the chunks are, or what groups of chunks look like, and then come up with a set of rules.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think like there's definitely changes to cognition with aging and with like some things being maybe easier when you're younger. I've heard like all sorts of different theories. I don't know whether there's like a really strong consensus on it, but I know some theories are kind of make the claim that procedural learning tends to be a bit easier when you're younger, at least for some sorts of skills. That's an argument that's often made with language learning, that, you know, because kids are very good procedural learners for a lot of the linguistic skills, they are able to acquire like fluency maybe a little bit faster than adults who, you know, can think about the rules, think about the grammar, but maybe are a little bit less, have less quick access to it. But I don't really know about situations like chess. I haven't really seen any like age-related studies or show like chess expertise based on, you know, age of acquisition and, you know, differential skills there. But I think...
Define procedural learning again. I understand.
Okay, yeah. So again, this declarative procedural distinction is you know, sort of widely held in all psychology. Declarative is all the things that you have like consciously accessible. So it's a memory system that's largely associative. It's something that like you think of one thing that reminds you of something else. And it's sort of all linked together like that. And it's things that, you know, you can articulate. So I know the letter A or this kind of thing. Procedural memory, and, you know, there's different versions of it as well, but one of the major theories of procedural learning is that it's you're learning like if-then patterns. So you're learning sort of like, this is the situation, then I do this action. And so it's a little bit more kind of like the motor learning. It's a little bit more something where you are... you see some situation and then you take the particular action with that step. And so in this sort of viewpoint, the problem with declarative learning, a lot of the issue is retrieval access. Like, how do you access the memory that you need for that particular situation? Whereas a lot of procedural learning is, again, like tuning that sort of if-then condition pattern so that, you know, it's very strongly ingrained as a habit that in this particular situation, you take the right action. And so a lot of practicing is training this procedural learning. Whereas, you know, reading examples, studying, seeing more things is maybe more declarative.
And like, what's the difference between, so like, let's say I want to be a great novelist.
Yeah.
So I can read 1,000 novels, or I can also learn, this is what the hero's journey looks like. So boom, here's Star Wars.
Yeah.
And like, are those two different types of learning?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's another distinction, which would be between like implicit learning and explicit learning. So implicit learning is like, I see a lot of examples and then I infer or I generalize some kind of idea about the examples. And then explicit learning is like, I tell you exactly what the examples all mean and what they all have in common. And so I think that for a lot of domains, explicit learning is definitely best. Like, it's probably better to be told exactly how to do certain things. But the reason that it's hard is that often the explicit rules are kind of complicated and contradictory. So learning by lots of examples and sort of inferring this kind of complex pattern. I mean, this is what all the, you know, large language models and neural nets and deep learning, that's what they're doing, right? Is they're inferring like a really complicated rule from just seeing a lot of examples and getting feedback on it. Now, I think, for the particular skill and how you're learning it, I think it really does depend. But I mean, if I were trying to know what is good writing, I would probably want to know the rules, but I would understand that those rules are like a really gross oversimplification of what makes good writing. And so I'd want lots of examples to like complement that. So I think for a creative skill, I don't think there's any way around going through all the examples. But I think it's still helpful for someone to be able to point out, oh, this is the thing that a lot of these things have in common. It's called the hero's journey. And then you can see that in, because you are armed with this concept, you can see that. Whereas it might take you, you know, thousands of examples before you would like just figure that out on your own and be able to apply it to your work.
Right. So it's like learning versus meta-learning. So I'm going to either, so I could learn the traditional way, which is the 10,000 hours, and I'm going to read 1,000 books, I'm going to write 1,000 books, I'm going to get some feedback on them, and I'm going to be, at the end of that, I'm going to be a pretty good writer. Or I'm also going to read about great writers and how they describe how they write. And so here's Joseph Campbell with The Hero's Story. Here's, you know, maybe Kurt Vonnegut, and he's got some books on writing. Here's Ray Bradbury. He's got his books on writing, and Stephen King has a book on writing. I'm going to read those and kind of meta-learn what writers say about writing.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I were starting out on a skill, I would start with the explicit instructions for most of them, because it's going to be much faster than going through countless examples. But I think you'd also recognize that there's going to be probably a limitation to that. You can probably get from like zero to like a decent beginner or novice level for a lot of creative skills just by following, you know, explicit advice. You just read a style guide, like, don't do these things, and then you don't do it. But then you get a little further and you realize, oh, actually, you know, adverbs aren't always the devil or something like that. And then you start mixing it up and you're like, okay, I like what this person's doing and why does it work? And you're going through it and you're building that library of patterns. So I think, you know, the chess player understanding rules of chess, like, you want to maintain control of the center, and, you know, you don't want to be like the first pieces you send out aren't usually the rooks, and like these kinds of rules of thumb and heuristics that you learn explicitly are very important. But they're also probably not going to get you to grandmaster level, just because by the time you're at the grandmaster level, the actual rules that you were playing with, you were making it explicit, would be so complicated that, you know, I think the intuition approach,
too many exceptions.
Or there'd just be like this huge set of, you know, if then, or do this in this situation or that in that situation. So it's going to be too complicated. But I mean, as a starting point, you definitely, if there's any low hanging fruit of like, this helps in this situation, definitely go for it, right?
You know, a great story is you have the story of Octavia Butler, mm-hmm. who's a science fiction writer.
Yeah.
Great, great writer. I once went to hear her speak, and just really smart about the art of writing. Yeah. But I was struck in your story about her, how hard it was for her first. The writing, and how did she get better?
I mean, yeah, Octavia Butler was someone who, there's like a few people you do in the research where like you really resonate with them. And despite her life story being so different from mine, I just had so much deep empathy for her journey, because basically she was someone who from a little girl wanted to be a science fiction writer. And just like her entire environment is like not conducive for that goal happening, but she does it anyways and just like grinds it out and sticks to it. And so the thing that I kind of got from that is that, especially in something like science fiction writing, where it's not merely about mastering the craft of writing, but also understanding the kind of the ecosystem in which the writer works and publishes and all these sort of details, is that having access to a community, having access to these influences that can kind of get you up to best practices, get you close to that ballpark, like kind of all the little like rules of thumb, all the things that we were talking about, like you get those, that is going to, you know, get you so much closer than just trying to figure them out on your own. And so, you know, she spends like years and years just in frustration because she's cut off from that, or she's not realizing that that's what she needs. And it's, you know, making it very difficult for her to make a living writing.
And then eventually though, what do you think was the tipping point for her?
Yeah, well, the tipping point was definitely her going to the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop. So she had done a few workshops in LA where she was exposed to some people who were science fiction writers. And one of them, I think it was Harlan Ellison, he tells her, like, you should go to Pennsylvania and go to this Clarion science fiction writing workshop. And she's like, you know, not sure about this. She like barely ever left her home, but she gets on a Greyhound bus. She goes there. And she spends a while in this environment where she's in a big classroom with a bunch of people who are also writing science fiction. And they're like, okay, do a new short story for tomorrow. And then, you know, she's forced to write in this like pace that she's not used to. And then she shows there, and then everyone sort of discusses the work and dissects it. And I think this workshop environment, I think, is very good for writers, especially in like difficult fields, literary fields, because even if you just extract the role of the teacher, which is obviously very important, they had like, you know, professional science fiction writers who were running these classes, just being in an environment where you're with a lot of people who do know some things, but maybe not everything, quickly allows you to kind of acquire that knowledge about, you know, this is how I'm going to market my writing. This is how I'm going to improve my writing. This is what, you know, isn't working about my writing. And so, you know, the interesting thing is this kind of process of seeing what other people are doing and getting feedback, even though you would think that would like, you know, that imitative process is going to pull you away from your original vision. It's actually, that's when her creativity really leapt off the page. Like her early work was very derivative because she doesn't know what she's doing. So she's very much like copying kind of the bad stylistic side effects of like pulp science fiction writers rather than expressing herself the way she needs to.
It's very interesting, like this concept of, particularly with like writing, developing your own voice. Mm-hmm. But I think copying those earlier styles, and like she even refers to it, yeah, if somebody has a trouble with beginning novels, she tells her students, just take your favorite novels, yeah, and just write out the beginnings of those novels, just so you see what a great beginning is like. And it's like you almost build the muscle memory, because she says, write them out yourself,
yeah,
like word for word. You build the muscle memory almost of what a good beginning is like. And I like that approach. I think also in that workshop, what was really good for her was the forced deadlines. Write, yeah, a story by tomorrow. So she can't do it at her pace. Yeah. It builds an understanding that whether you have writer's block or not, whether you're motivated or not, you have to produce a story by tomorrow.
Yeah.
So like you're forced to build these raw skills that normally you might have had the bad habit of waiting for inspiration before you would, you know, use that skill. Now you have to use that skill whether you have inspiration or not.
I mean, I think you can see this across many different like professional streams of work, that like the people who enter an elite often go through this kind of almost like pressure cooker training environment. And sometimes, yeah, that's just a like a kind of almost occupational hazing to like prevent people from entering the field. But it does have a little bit of a cognitive science rationale in that when you're in this kind of intensive environment where you're getting a lot of practice, a lot of quick feedback, and you're often, you know, working on varied cases, you're working on varied situations, you can compress what would have been a much longer period of training if you were doing it sort of outside that environment. So, I mean, the amount of people who are like successful nonfiction authors that had a career in journalism is just because, you know, writing magazine pieces or things for these publications, it like it has really high editorial standards. There's really high sense of like rigor for like quoting sources and getting your facts right. And so you're basically going to be working under this environment that's going to force you to a fairly high level of skill. You know, and the downside is that there's a lot of pressure working in those environments and they can often be difficult to access. But I think if you understand why they work that way, you know, I think for Octavia Butler, going to that workshop was really what turned her career around.
Why do you think many successful actors, so some successful actors took acting classes, studied acting and so on, but many, many, many actors that are famous that we know about, that we see on shows every day, really were started with improv and never took an acting class, but took improv classes.
Yeah.
So like, why do you think that's the case?
That's interesting. I don't know. I think I don't think I know enough about acting and theater to say with any like strong level of certainty. But I do think that for a lot of skills that are kind of like the communication skills adjacent, a lot of what the skill is a kind of emotional self-regulation. And so I think like in an improv context where you are kind of thrown into situations that you need to adapt to emotionally, like, you know, okay, I need to be frightened now, I need to do this now. That trains a certain kind of ability there that maybe you don't normally encounter and don't normally get training in your everyday life. But it's not so much a, method. It's not so much a like, you know, well, this is the right way to act, and then you're following like some 8-step sequence. It's more just you have enough emotional self-regulation so that, you know, when you know you need to act a certain way, you can just turn it on or you can just manage yourself. Whereas, you know, most people in most situations are not forced to do that level of emotional self-regulation. You know, I'm having this interview now. All I have to do is like be pleasant and, you know, I'm not going to have to like cry at one part and be really excited at another. Like I don't have that ability and I don't need to use
it. You can cry if you want.
All right, Jay.
Like, but you know, maybe improv though, you get the quantity because like, let's say I'm studying acting. It's like, okay, here's a monologue, memorize it, come back and we're all going to do it. And, but an improv, that's an acting class. Improv class doesn't have the memory part. You're given a scene and now you have to just start off being the character in that scene. So you have to quickly go from character to character very quickly, as opposed to just studying one type of character per class. An improv class, you're probably doing many characters.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And you're also isolating the character part and not the memory part. There's no memorization.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there that like for a lot of skills that have, you know, several components, one of the things that like slows you down is if like one of those four or five components is the bottleneck, but you have to do all other four every single time you do it, it's going to slow down the amount of reps you can do. It's going to slow down how you're going to work on it.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I think about like painting or something. Painting, you usually do a drawing first and then you do a painting. And if you're doing something like, you know, a portrait or something, the drawing might take you a huge amount of time. So if what you're trying to get better at is like mixing the right colors or doing this kind of thing, you know, spending 80 hours on the drawing, that's actually like not helping you on that other skill, but it's going to slow you down. So I do think, you know, in that context, that kind of thinking of improv is like a drill for like the emotional self-regulation or being able to like quickly change states or characters or voices and not having to worry about like having memorized the speech. Yeah, that might be an advantage.
Why do you think for some skills it's better to be younger, for some skills it's better to be older? So I was talking to Arthur Brooks about this, who writes a lot about, he wrote a book From Strength to Strength about skills we have as when we're young, like mathematicians and physicists peak at 25, historians peak at the age of 69. So why do you think some skills are easier when you're older, like being a historian?
Well, I think the physics historian contrast is pretty easily explicable in terms of for physics, you need to have like a high working memory capacity. You need to be able to like juggle a lot of ideas in your head at once. And that fluid intelligence probably degrades faster. So it's something you probably peak at maybe in your early 20s. So you count the PhD training, this kind of thing. You know, you're probably at that kind of like sweet spot of you've acquired the knowledge of your discipline and you also have you know, the sort of raw horsepower in your brain at that young age that you can make this novel contribution. Whereas historians, I don't think that's the major bottleneck. The major bottleneck is just knowing a lot of history. And so when you're in your late 60s or something, you've just maybe, you know, if you've been a historian the whole time, you just read a lot more books. And so you can just easily cite off a lot more scholarly things than that. Whereas when you're 30, you just haven't had enough lifetime experience to be able to do that. So I do think that's probably a transition that you maybe want to do in your life, is that, like, you know, focus on those sort of high intellect requiring, solving like completely original problems, creative kind of domains when you're younger. And then as you're older, like, work toward things that build off of experience, build off of having a larger knowledge base. I think that's probably a transition that, you know, if you were, you know, thinking of it yourself as like a cognitive investor, that's where I would invest my money in the beginning, in those growth stocks of like, physics and math and stuff. And then later on, I would be focusing on like the long tail of, well, I've read 100 books on this, so I know my stuff.
What if I'm 80 years old and I really want to be a mathematician?
Yeah.
And I just haven't studied math at all.
I mean, I don't think, like, the decline is as precipitous as sometimes people make it out to be. Like, I sometimes have conversations with people who's like, I'm 60, can I still learn? And I remember doing sort of a research deep dive into like aging and learning, and the trend line for a lot of cognitive abilities, I mean, there is decline, but it's pretty flat for most people until later in life. And then there's more variability. And I think it's just related to the fact that some people get Alzheimer's or become senile and some people don't. So, you know, if you're in that you didn't happen to you category, you know, maybe you're not quite as sharp as you were when you're 21, but it's not like, you know, you're just a completely different person when you're older. So I think you probably can learn those things. It probably would just take you a little bit longer than it would have when you were 20. I think maybe the bigger obstacle we have at that point is that, you know, when you're young, you're constantly learning new things. You constantly have this mindset of like, I'm going to invest in this skill. It's going to pay dividends for the rest of my life. And so when you're older, especially if you've spent a whole career where you were just focusing on the thing that you were already good at, focusing on the profession that you'd already mastered, I think it just can be kind of humbling to go back to like that, you know, mindset of being a student. And I think that kind of, that emotional difference is often bigger than any like cognitive difficulty.
Yeah. And also when you're younger, you can focus, you could spend much more time doing something.
Yeah.
You could say to yourself, okay, if this takes me a couple years, that's fine. Mm-hmm. When you're older, you're not necessarily going to want to spend 8 years learning how to be a good writer.
Yeah.
Whereas I probably did spend 8 years learning how to be a good writer. Like, before I got anything published, I wrote 3,000 words a day, every day.
Wow.
For at least 8 years before my first thing ever was published. And then I'd go to the library, and whatever I was reading, I would also read the literary criticism of what I was reading. And just to learn, like, okay, why was this book by Hemingway considered good? Is it because of what I'm thinking, or what did these other critics think? And on and on. But I could afford to do that then. Now I wouldn't be able to afford to do that. And so that there's that too.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I think you're right. Like, I'm thinking about a lot of people talk about language learning. And one of the things that I thought was really interesting from the research on language learning is that people generally have this impression like kids are the fastest learners of languages. And there do seem to be some truth to that. Like, if you look at, you know, what is the eventual level of attainment, if you immigrate to a country when you're like 4, you're probably going to reach a near native level of the local language. But if you immigrate when you're 40, you probably won't. You'll probably have a noticeable accent. You'll make mistakes even after you've been there for the same amount of time as the 4-year-old. But when you do like studies that are sort of like looking at, okay, you were taking kids, we're taking teenagers, we're taking adults, and we're putting them through a language class, the kids don't usually come out on top. Actually, the adolescents and adults usually learn in this sort of restricted range. They learn faster, which makes sense when you think about like a 4-year-old's brain isn't fully developed. They can't sit in class and pay attention. The adult can like study and use flashcards and do all those sorts of things. And so I think sometimes we get mixed up when we're thinking about like, well, how was it so easy for me to learn X when I was a kid? And you neglect that, well, you didn't have any other responsibilities or pressures on your time, and you just spent like 10 times as much time doing it. So that's why you got so good at it. Whereas now you're finding it hard to like justify a couple hours a week doing X. And so you're wondering why the returns are lower. So sometimes you can just explain things that way.
You know, no matter what, it's always interesting studying the learning process and how to learn faster and so on, because as almost everybody knows, that learning curve, particularly when it's moving, when you're learning something you're excited about and you're learning really fast, it just feels good. It gets you into that flow state. It's kind of like a component of well-being and happiness. And your book really, again, it's these, you know, the book is Get Better at Anything, 12 Maxims for Mastery. Really understanding these maxims and the stories you tell, and then, you know, ranging from Tetris to flying an airplane to everything in between. It's really important to learn how to learn. And I think these books you write are great. I really enjoyed this one. A lot of great storytelling in it. So Get Better at Anything by Scott H. Young. Why do you have the H? Are there too many Scott Youngs out there?
Well, yeah, there actually are. You know, Neil Young's dad was called Scott Young. He's a sports journalist. And for a while, like, the ghost of his biography was like haunting my thing. Like, he occasionally would be like, Scott Young is a deceased sports writer on the thing. So yeah, Scott H. Young is for that reason. Also, my website is scotthyoung.com, because 20 years ago when I was buying the domain, they didn't have scottyoung.com. They had scotthyoung.com, and the rest is history.
Well, excellent, Scott. Thanks again. I think this is your third time on the podcast. Yeah. Thanks once again for joining us. It's one of my favorite topics in the world. So come on back anytime you got something to talk about with learning, and or for whatever reason you want to come back. So thanks again, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's great chatting with you.
Fidelity. What's it cost to invest with the Fidelity app?
Start with as little as $1 with no account fees or trade commissions on U.S. stocks and ETFs.
That's music to my ears.
I can only talk.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Zero account fees apply to retail brokerage accounts only. $0 commission applies to online U.S. equity trades and ETFs and retail Fidelity accounts. Sell order assessment fee not included. Some account types and securities excluded. Details at fidelity.com/commissions. Fidelity Brokerage Services LLC, member NYSE SIPC.
From a flat tire in the city to a dead battery on a distant drive, AAA is partnering with T-Mobile for Business to accelerate response times and get more drivers back on the road fast. Our nationwide connectivity powers location telematics, so AAA's fleet can find stranded drivers quickly while being fully equipped with the in-vehicle tools to have answers when they get there. This is elevating the member experience. This is AAA with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.